two more panelists to come out here for you guys to share some of their very excellent storytelling. So give a warm welcome, please, for Dan Robson and Sean Fitzgerald. All right, so maybe I'll just start it, you know, the way that I did with the other two. And I know I'm the host and I could introduce you guys, but I'll let you take it away and introduce yourselves. I guess I'm kind of lazy in that way, but I also like hearing the way that people like to introduce themselves. So
I like that they're the other two and that we're the
two. The other two, and you're the now two.
They're the others, and we are the people. I'm Sean Fitzgerald, managing editor of The Athletic in Toronto. I tell, like Clokey, stories about feelings and puppy dogs and origin stories. And I spend a lot of time asking people questions for a segment we call 20 Questions, which is just sort of an excuse to really creep into people's background and climb all over their family history, their family tree. And when I sit down with them, it makes them feel really awkward because I ask them about, like, their second favorite cat who died when they were 12 and was bought to them by a favorite aunt of theirs. So, I don't really follow the team, Leafs, Argos, Raptors, Blue Jays, anything. I don't have the attention span. I'm not smart enough. So I just sort of do a bit of everything. Fluffy, shaggy dog stories.
And I'm Dan Robson. I actually just recently joined The Athletic from Sportsnet, so only have written a few stories for The Athletic so far. But basically, I focus mostly on features and doing long-form content. I just got back from Nunavut, so I have a bit of a cold right now, so just bear with me if I sound a little off.
All right. Well, I will maybe start. I don't know, Dan. I mean, you just brought up you got back from Nunavut, so I know it's something that you're going to be working on, but do you maybe want to give us a little insight on what you were doing out there, what some subscribers can look forward to?
Sure, everyone's subscribers, so I can do that. Yeah, I'm working on a story about Jordan Tutu's return to Rankin Inlet, which is the community he grew up in. For the first time, he's playing in a hockey tournament. He left when he was 14 years old, so he's going back to play in a hockey tournament that's dedicated to his brother, Terrence Tutu, who committed suicide right before Jordan played for the World Juniors back in 2002. So Jordan has retired in October officially. So I went up to hang out with Jordan and his family to sort of get a scene of what was happening in Rankin Inlet and get a sense of what hockey means to that space, that community. I previously had the privilege of going up to Nunavut to write a story about these boys from Whale Cove several years ago when I was at Sportsnet. And I got a little bit of a taste of what was very unique about the sport and what it means to Inuk communities in Nunavut. So I was able to kind of go back and explore that a little bit more, meet some of those kids again, and hang out with Jordan as he sort of takes this next step in his life working with Indigenous communities.
And I guess, Sean, you've had a number of 20 questions on this site, a number of features. If any of you have read Sean's stuff, he's very into very intricate details, lots of internet stalking, which ends up becoming really, really wonderful stories, really great storytelling. And one of the ones you did last season was really out of left field, but it was really quite interesting, and it was about what the heck is with Mike Babcock's accent, because I don't think anyone really knows, like, what's that accent, you know, we know where he's from, but it's just, his voice is a little weird, and everyone loves to imitate Mike Babcock, so why don't you maybe talk about that story a little bit?
Yeah, no, it started in a really intellectual level. I was sitting in the back of a Mike Babcock press conference down at Air Canada Centre, and I just sort of was listening quietly. I'm like, that accent doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard. When you really think about it, like, Mike Babcock is nominally from Saskatoon, which is in Saskatchewan, which is a province in Canada. And nothing in the way he speaks really sounds like anybody you ever met from Saskatoon. Has anybody been to Saskatoon or, like, met people from Saskatoon?
I lived in Saskatchewan, and nobody speaks like that.
Does anybody speak like Mike
Babcock? Nobody.
So that's the intellectual grounds from which I sort of sprung that idea. Is like, what's up with that? Like, the academic of where did that come from? And everybody has a favorite Mike Babcock impression. My personal favorite, I think, is Darren Dreger, though I'm also told Steve Dangle. I haven't heard him do it directly. I'm told Steve Dangle does a very good one as well. Dangle Navy. So what it did was I started calling linguists and piecing together a bit of Mike Babcock's background. So he lists himself as being from Saskatoon, and that's where he spent his formative years. But because his dad was sort of in mining, he moved around a lot. He spent some of the first years of his life in a place called Tungsten, which was up in the Yukon. It doesn't even exist anymore. It was, you know, created to mine tungsten. And all it was a mining town where the company flew people in. I think there was a population of 400 people who, you know, when he was 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, were coming in from all over Canada. So his exposure to English, if you will, when he became verbal, would have been around people who came from all over Canada, not just one region. I mean, granted, he was in the north, but then the family moved to another government-created camp in northern Manitoba. And it was the stories that you find back in the Globe and Mail. It was late 60s. The Globe and Mail sent somebody up there, and you know it was 90% male, a lot from parts of Manitoba, but also from northern Ontario. So when you get people from all over these different regions, you get sort of this melange of accents and people speaking in different ways. And this is where he would have learned to speak and become verbal and interacted and made friends and played hockey. And then they settled in Saskatoon. So if that maybe explains the origin story of where that interesting accent comes from, that's sort of like a snapshot of different regions in northern and western Canada, the secondary part that I found really interesting was how he maintained it. Now, I have this terrible habit. I don't know if you do, Dan. You're a lot smarter than I am, so maybe you don't. But like if I'm interviewing somebody, if I'm talking to somebody from, say, Alabama, like if I'm talking to somebody who's from the South, unconsciously, and I swear to you, by the end of the conversation, I'll start like messing around with my vowels. Like, yeah, dang, that's a real interesting point there you got there. And I'm like, wait a second. And I'm not doing it on purpose. I'm not doing it to be cute. And nobody's hung up on me to say that I'm offending them, but it just happens. Like sometimes when you're exposed to a different language, and this is what the linguist said, that, you know, Mike Babcock lived in Quebec. He went to school at McGill. After that, he spent time in the UK playing professional hockey. Like he spent time in Michigan, and Michigan has a very distinct accent. And he also spent time in California, and we all know the Californian accent can be interesting. So when you move places, you can absorb part of that accent, and it's through no fault of your own. It just happens. I mean, you know, listen to your favorite Hollywood celebrities. Gwyneth Paltrow can sound like a wherever she wants to be sometimes. But what the linguist said is that there's an interesting psychological aspect to it, that for him to maintain that same very distinct accent that he had from growing up in Tungsten, from growing up in Cedar Falls, Manitoba, from growing up in northwestern Ontario, that says almost as much about Mike Babcock and his sense of self-confidence and his sense of knowing who he is and his comfort in his own skin. That says almost as much about the way that he talks as it does from where he grew up. That he can go from, you know, Saskatoon to McGill in Montreal to London, England, to Detroit, to California, and come back sounding exactly the same as he did when he would have left in, you know, the 1980s. Says as much about him and his personality and his psychological makeup as it does about the language. And that's sort of where the story went. And I just kept following it down that rabbit hole. And luckily, linguists who are, again, very smart from the University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, University of Saskatchewan, felt comfortable to pick up the phone and talk about it with a strange sports reporter. Because when you get down to it and exploring it, it really is something that's sort of this interesting profile of a guy who's very comfortable in being where he is in Canada.
And very stubborn.
Exceptionally stubborn. That's part of it too, is that the two prongs of the Mike Babcock accent would be where he's from, but also that sense of self-confidence and stubbornness.
And Dan, you know, you said you're new, you haven't had that many stories yet, but I mean, the two that you've done for The Athletic have been fantastic. The Ray Emery story, I know that was a really long time in the works. Has anyone read the story that Dan wrote about what happened to Ray Emery? Whoever doesn't have their hand up should go and read it when they get home. It's your homework from Puck Talks. You know, Ray Emery passed away, I guess a year ago, almost a year ago now.
In July.
So it was, you know, they were out, they had the charity hockey tournament that weekend, and they were out swimming late at night, and Ray Emery died that weekend, and you took it to so many more levels and really went into who Ray Emery was and what really happened to Ray. So do you maybe want to talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. It's actually one of the stories when I was coming over to The Athletic that I talked with James Merle about, sort of thinking this is something that I'd like to look into a little bit more. At the time, this summer when the incident happened, I was actually up at a cottage, and one of the people I was with was sort of a from the Cayuga area, which is where Ray grew up, and he had received a text message saying something might have happened to Ray. So that kind of got passed around the people at the cottage. I was working for Sportsnet at the time. Didn't report it because it's not the kind of thing you want to break. You want to make sure that you obviously have the information on it. But when it came out after, and sort of the mystery around what had happened that morning sort of was left untouched, I thought that there was much more, not only to learn about what happened to Ray that morning, but also what happened to Ray in his life. Because throughout his life, if you sort of followed his headlines, he was sort of someone who was, you know, a lot of fans loved him, a lot of fans hated him. He had a lot of ups and downs, and many of them were self-inflicted. And in some cases, they weren't. Sometimes it was just his own body giving out on him. But he was always sort of a bit of a mystery. And as I started to ask a few questions about it, that mystery began to unfold a little bit more. For example, he was adopted. He never really talked about that ever growing up, or any of the. He was adopted by his stepfather. His biological mother raised him, but he never really spoke about that part of his life. And I think they're going back and trying to piece together the narrative of his life helped. For me to try and get a better sense of who Ray was and how he ended up on a dock that morning, jumping into the water at 6 a.m.
And I mean, I think there was a lot of parts of that story that were really striking and emotional. I guess, how did you just feel reporting on that story? You know, his death came at a time where it seemed like a lot of the people in his life thought that he was going to start turning things around. You had some stuff from his former fiance, Keisha Shante. You know, she kind of had it in her mind that, you know, maybe they'd find each other again, you know. That seems like some really heartbreaking interviews that you probably would have done.
Yeah, it was. It was definitely sad. The whole process was, I mean, I think I did more than 24 interviews or more than that, probably. Like, not a lot of the interviews I did didn't make it into the story just because they didn't really fit, but they helped inform the background of what I was writing about Ray. But yeah, I mean, one of the first interviews I did was with Ray's brother, and from there I went on to his family and his mother and his father and his grandfather. And all of those interviews, I went in knowing it was going to be quite sad, but they were quite natural conversations because the people that they wanted to share something about Ray, they wanted to have a conversation about someone they missed a great deal, and to fill in, I think, some gaps that they realized that most people didn't know about his life. So as sad as those conversations were, sometimes they were also quite funny, and they were quite uplifting, and they were quite interesting, and they were very enlightening in terms of trying to get a full picture of a hockey player or a person that sort of lived in headlines and lived in stories that were told about him, but I don't think ever really created a complete picture of him. So it was a lot of tough conversations, a lot of tears, a lot of difficult interviews to get. But in the end, sort of as I got one interview and got another interview, they kind of led to more and more once they knew sort of the nature of the story I was trying to tell.
If there, what was, you know, one that maybe left you a little bit more sad afterwards? Like, was there one that really, really stood out to you as something that was quite heartbreaking?
Yeah, I mean, I went to his parents' house in Fenland Falls, and it was just before, it was a few weeks before Christmas, and just sort of going in, it was a beautiful night. The snow was sort of softly falling that night on this, like, little tiny bungalow, and Ray's truck, his white Ram, was parked out front. I knew his truck, his brother had told me that he'd left it there, so his truck was parked out front. His grandfather's apartment is attached to the house. They were all there. And going in and chatting with his parents, Charlene and Paul, I was there for 3 hours, so we were going through, we looked at the decorations she'd put up, and she explained how difficult that had been. And we went downstairs, and she showed me his ashes and showed me all the portraits and pictures that he kept over the years, everything they brought back from his house in Ancaster and brought home. So that conversation was one that was filled with a lot of tears, but also some laughter and a lot of just getting everything that they wanted to say about Ray out. So it was a difficult one. I remember I drove home after I went and saw George after he was his incredible grandfather, who's a real character. We spoke for another hour and a half, and then I drove home. I got home at like 2 a.m, I think, that night, but I drove home that whole night, and I just felt heavy. Like it was just a lot to take in, and it was a lot for them to unload.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility to the people that you spoke to? Like, it seems like that would be a difficult story to, you know, you want to do the storytelling justice and you want to get the whole picture, but you also kind of maybe respect the family or keep some, like, was there anything that you were maybe really torn about not including in the story?
It was very difficult because Ray, there's a lot of, there was rumors about Ray and a lot of sort of ongoing things about Ray's substance abuse and things that he had done in different periods of his career that were already out there in the press. I mean, it wasn't something that I was going to be breaking. It was something that was already part of who Ray was in terms of what we thought of him. So I had to bring those things up with them. I wasn't going to not go without asking them about it, but I tried to do it in a respectful, empathetic way. And leaving that place, I did feel an obligation to telling as complete a picture of the man that they were describing as possible. I wanted to make sure that I showed the sides of him that others hadn't seen that they had shared with me. So that was really important. But at the same time, I wasn't going to then not deal with those other things that were also part of who he was and part of the complicated reality of a life.
Like I said, you know, homework for everyone who hasn't read it, do so, because it's really great. And I mean, I don't think there was anyone who really went any kind of depth into what actually happened to Ray Emery. You know, once they had the press conference with the police in Hamilton, that was kind of it. So homework for everyone who showed up today. And so, Sean, you mentioned your 20 questions.
They could actually probably start reading it now while I'm talking. It's on their phone. There's no reason to listen. You can just be quiet for a couple of minutes. You guys read Dan's story. It's really good, and it's way better than anything I'll have to say.
I thought I was really self-deprecating and, like, pessimistic.
You're being factual, dude. No. Just facts. Dan's story is amazing. I'm not. His story was amazing.
Dan's story is amazing, but you are also very amazing.
I am also here, but I'm not amazing.
I'm not going to argue with you in front of our guests. So your 20 questions are fantastic. I'm sure everyone's read a 20 questions from Sean, I would hope. Yeah? Hands? You've read them? Okay. Yeah.
One of our editors is in the back. He better have raised his hand. Ian, are you better? No? Okay.
They're very good, extremely well-researched. I know I see, you know, some of the people that you've interviewed are even, you know, I think Jeff Merrick tweeted about it, and he was like, you know, Fitzy brought up some stuff that I like. Was like, oh, how did you even know that? So how do you prep for these 20 question stories? You know, we'll get into some of the ones that you've done, but I guess just when you're sitting down and you say, I'm going to do a 20 questions with Jeff Merrick, what kind of corners of the internet are you stalking exactly?
20 questions is, again, I think Cloak was up here earlier talking about stealing. It started when I was at National Post. Joe O'Connor stole it from Dave Stubbs, who was at the Montreal Gazette, who stole it from Corey Wolfe, who was at the Saskatoon Star Phoenix. So the whole concept of 20 questions has been stolen several times, and I'm sure the statute of limitations has expired, so I'm free to say that now. But the idea is to take somebody that you're interested in, so, and hopefully that somebody that your readers, your audience, will be interested in. So over the years, Bill Daly, P.K. Subban, Don Cherry, Haley Wickenheiser, Karina LeBlanc, the Canadian Olympic goalkeeper from 2012 London Olympics, and that crazy, amazing run they had with the women's soccer to the bronze medal. Somebody that you're interested in. And part of that interest, and you know, Jeff Merrick's an interesting example, just because it was fairly recent. But Jeff Merrick's just, you know, if you're a hockey fan and you're a hockey consumer, that you watch it and listen to it, he's everywhere. He's done the podcast, the Merrick Wyshynski podcast, on Sportsnet. You know, he was on AM 640. He's done a bunch of things. So I was interested in sort of what formed him, where he came from, sort of the interactions he's had with over the years. And of course, you know, he came up as a wrestling fan. He's, you know, came up in the same cohort with George Strombolopoulos. He had a job where he, you know, dug graves out in the West End of Toronto. He was an actual literal grave digger. And one of the graves that he dug was for a guy named Harold Ballard, who used to own a hockey team. I'm told that is some repute in the city, though not at the time that Harold Ballard owned the team. So he was, and this is his honest truth, he was the last guy to throw dirt on Harold Ballard's coffin. Like, literally. He was the guy who was there digging it in the quiet corner of the cemetery and shoveled dirt on Harold Ballard's coffin. So, you know, depending on your karmic values, you can shake his hand next time you see him, maybe. So what it involves is, like, I really like learning about people before I sit down with them. And the 20 questions, I can ask anything. I can ask everything from, you know, dealing with your job today, to any controversies you've had, to something funny or something controversial you've said in the past or done in the past. But the learning part is the part that I really like the most. It's the research. It's the, if you have the Toronto Library card, if there's researchers in the room or if there's lawyers or just, you know, random private investigators, you know, that's fine. I'm sure we have them. You can go in and check the full archives of the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star for free, like all the way back with your Toronto Library card. And I do that. And Jeff Merrick, I think what he was talking about was, I found a picture. Jeff Merrick was adopted. I found a picture of his adopted mother when she appeared in a Toronto Star bridal spread in 1957, I think. And she was a picture in her new gown that she had just purchased. And she was modeling it for the Toronto Star photographer. And underneath, you know, talked a little bit about the wedding gown and how excited she was about the wedding. He'd never seen that photo before. Ever. It's a small thing. It didn't make it into the story, but like it's part of, you know, me learning about them and showing them the respect that if they're going to give me the time for 20 questions, that I'm going to make it worth their while and hopefully, you know, ask them questions. And again, people we know, people who've been asked a million questions. PK Subban's been asked 1,001 questions, but I asked him about the times that he played pickup basketball with his sister, who briefly held the OUA scoring record for women's basketball when she played at York University. And he went off and he was surprised to hear the question and went off and started showing me the post-up move that he used to beat her the last time they'd played. And it was amazing, if you believe him. I think she disputed that later. But so really digging in and hopefully through that effort, one, gain the respect of the people sitting across from you that, okay, this person's done the work. Like what Dan does when he goes to do his long form, that he does all the research before so that he's not wasting anybody's time, but also showing that he values the time they're giving. And then in turn, and this sounds like a marketing line, but it's true that, you know, through that interaction, it drives more value to subscribers and readers and your audience because the stuff you're getting is hopefully stuff that you haven't gotten anywhere before.
And that no one else is getting either, right?
Well, that would be the hope, yeah. That's what my mortgage hopes for when I keep getting paid to do that stuff. No, it's fun. It really is. It's like digging. I'm not Indiana Jones. I wear a hat, but I'm not nearly as attractive nor as adventurous. I have asthma, so I can't go to all of those interesting places. This is my archaeology. This is my digging for treasure. This is my, you know, outrunning boulders, finding these interesting tidbits that you can ask people and hopefully engage them in a conversation that maybe they even haven't even had, even if they've been in the media forever. I found an article in the Kingston Whig Standard from 6 years before Don Cherry was born that showed that his dad was in a near fatal car accident on a rural road outside Kingston. And he had no idea. He knew that his dad was in an accident before, but he thought it was before he was born. But, I mean, how often do you ask stuff about your parents? And so he didn't even know, and I was able to sort of slide that across and had an interesting conversation. Again, it didn't make it into the story, but it at least engages him in the process, which, I mean, Don Cherry's been in the media for the better part of 50 years almost. To get him engaged was something interesting, and, you know, that turned out to be an interesting 20 questions, interesting in quotation marks.
Depending on how you feel about Don Cherry, I guess.
And his relationship with Donald Trump, yes.
I guess you mentioned Indiana Jones. What is your holy grail of 20 questions? Like, what's your favorite one that you've ever done? Or what's the one that you really want to do that they keep just... You know,
that's interesting.
Like,
you know, there is one, and I exchange emails. You wouldn't know this, but I exchange emails about this very thing today. My great white whale, the 20 questions that I've been pursuing, and this isn't hyperbole, I'm not exaggerating, for at least 10 years, Brian Burke. I've wanted to ask Brian Burke 20 questions for years and years and years. And we're talking about interesting characters, right? Like, Brian Burke is a guy who has led a million different lives in the NHL, from the Hartford Whalers to NHL headquarters to the Flames to, I believe he spent time in Toronto. I'd have to double check that. He was GM here. He was GM. But then again, so that's his LinkedIn resume, right? Then you look at Brian Burke, the person. And Brian Burke, we all know truculence. What were the other ones? Truculence, belligerence? Pugnacity. See, that's basically entered the Toronto lexicon. That if we redo the Toronto coat of arms, it'd be like a raccoon smiling or maybe giving us all the bird. And it'd be like pugnacity, truculence, and the third one. And that's the Toronto coat of arms moving forward. So he has that side to him. But he also has this other side that, you know, he's a horse guy. And he'll very quietly donate, you know, racehorses to the Toronto Police Service with no cost attached other than, you know, requesting that they name the horse a certain name. He does, you know, he slept outside for Covent House outside to help, you know, bring awareness to the problem of homeless youth in the city. He does a lot of charity. So he has the bluster and he has this other side, this incredibly sort of civic-minded side. And I've been trying to get him to do a 20 questions for 10 years. And I got an email today that I get to sit down with him next week for a 20 questions.
I'm excited for that one. And I mean, recently, he's been a really huge ally for women's hockey. I think every time that something's happening with something big, at least, you know, I always hear him talking about bringing his girls to Fury's games. And, you know, I think I heard it at least a dozen times that he bought 10 tickets to the All-Star game. So
and
he seems interesting.
And the family started You Can Play, which I don't think you can overstate the impact and the importance that You Can Play and that movement and the drive to raise awareness for inclusivity in obviously starting in hockey, but in all sports. That started with the Burke family. That started with Brendan Burke, his late son, and that's been continued with Patrick Burke and continues even now with the family sort of stepping away from it. But that was a movement started by the Burke family. So, I mean, say what you will about his LinkedIn resume and all the things he's done on the hockey, his contributions on and off the ice, his interactions, that's part of what really interests me. And I'm not kidding. I've been chasing him since about 2009. And yeah, we get to sit down with him next week.
So that's your great white whale. What's your holy grail? What would be your favorite 20 questions that you've done?
20 questions that I've done. Oh man. There
one elements. Favorite. I don't want to hear other ones. Just one.
I mean, PK was super entertaining because we got him in a car wash. So the car wash is when, you know, a celebrity, and, you know, you see it through entertainment, you see it in sports, where they're selling something or they're pitching something. He was pitching a charitable foundation that he and his family was working with. But with the car wash, it means you're on, like, CP24 at 6:30 a.m., and then you're on CFRB at 7:30, and then, you know, you're doing Global, and you're doing all of the different medias, TSN, Sportsnet, all of that stuff. And I think I got him at, you know, 3:30 in the afternoon. So he'd been doing this for a good long time. But it was just like I was the first interview he'd done. Like, he had that energy. And it wasn't put on. It was absolutely authentic. And he was fully engaged and fully immersed in the conversation, which is the key for 20 questions, because you can't have somebody sort of sleepwalk through it. I mean, my favorite parts are always when I catch them with something where you see the light go on, where it's something that they haven't considered and something that might be the product of research or just natural curiosity, that you want to sit down with this person because you want to learn something. That, you know, Jay Baruchel came out with a book, The Canadian Actor, not long ago, and part of his book, he talked about his father, who was kind of a shady mobster-type character in Montreal, and how, you know, he sort of mentioned in passing about how he sought office at one point. So what I did is I went back and I, again, this isn't any award-winning journalism, but I went back into the Montreal Gazette archives and found out the exact vote count that Jay Baruchel's father got in that election. It was 126 votes. He did not win. But like the other thing was, is that I found quotes and stories that were done. You know, they do, you know, the local reporter does, you know, hear all the candidates in this and tell me your platform. And his was completely bonkers. Like it was fueled by rage. So again, like I found these quotes and I found the numbers and during the course of the conversation sort of, you know, slipped the pages onto the table. And obviously he'd never seen them before. He was just a kid when that happened. But it leads to a better conversation. And that's the stuff I really like, because better conversations, interesting conversation. And again, I'm not here from the marketing department, but just as a journalist, it makes things more interesting for everybody out here who's giving us your time to read and, you know, also giving us your money to read it. So it's the value driven to the audience that ultimately makes it really interesting for me, because I like it when there's something that I haven't thought of or seen before that's on the page in front of me as the product of an interview.
So you have the really well-researched questions, and then you ask if, you know, I think you asked about Gritty in jail. Like, how did you start talking about Gritty, like, stabbing Carlton the Bear in jail with Jay Baruchel? Like, how do conversations get to that point? Because I was walking down the street, I think, and reading it, which is not smart, and I laughed out loud, and there was a group of people at the bus stop. They're like, what's wrong with her? Is she okay? Like, everyone's staring at me, but I was laughing at Jay Baruchel talking about Gritty, like, getting, like, shivved in jail. Or, like, how does that happen?
No, I believe it was Carlton who would get shivved in prison.
Someone got stabbed in prison. No. Some mascot.
Jay Baruchel was very convinced that Carlton the Bear would not do well in prison because he was not equipped for that sort of lifestyle.
He's so cute.
Carlton?
He's so cute.
Okay.
You can't stab Carlton.
I don't
want
to go
bear.
Off script here, but has anybody read or come across why Carlton the Bear is the mascot for the Toronto Maple Leafs? This is an honest question. Carlton Street, yes. I don't have a problem with the name, and the number on the back is 60. But like a polar bear. Like I were there polar bears back when Conn Smythe was building Maple Leaf Gardens? Like, they're building the Great Depression. Oh, the workers had to deal with the Great Depression, and polar bears were roaming up and down Carlton Street. God damn it, we got to name this mascot. Like, I don't get that. I would love to have sat in retroactively in the marketing meeting where it's like, you know what we need? We need a big, friggin' dark, soulless-eyed bear. And that's going to sell our franchise to children across the city of Toronto. I would read an oral history of that marketing pitch meeting. I'm like, no. He can't have pupils. Has to be completely soulless. You have to be able to look through the full sands of time when you look in Carlton the Bear's eyes. No, of course he's a fucking bear. That's what I want to read. That's the story I want to read. Can we do a long
That's
form on that?
That's a story you should write.
Can I pitch that?
That sounds perfect.
Ian?
What's that?
Ian?
Ask Carlton one question.
Carlton, what the fuck?
Carlton, why are you a bear, Carlton? Yeah. And then meanwhile, the mascot starts having an existential crisis. It's like, what am I? He didn't even know he was a bear, maybe.
See? Like honestly, like Harold Ballard, we talked about it. Like, he had a sheepdog or something. If you look at the old, you know, Toronto Maple Leafs pictures from when they were really terrible in the 80s, like, there was a sheepdog on the ice with them. You're like, what the fuck's the bear? Well, obviously, it's with Harold Ballard. But a bear. Like, the bear just materialized.
When did it come?
I don't know. Like, was the bear always there? I don't know. Like you take a look at, like, okay, Yuppie. Okay, Montreal Canadiens have Yuppie, right? We got Yuppie. Yuppie, okay, Yuppie, I mean, the Montreal Expos, rest in peace. He's sort of an orphan mascot, so they pick him up. So I get Yuppie. You look at, okay, Gritty's a phenomenon. We'll leave Gritty alone. But, like, others... I mean, Spartacat kind of makes sense. I don't know. But, like Carlton the Bear has nothing to do with Toronto. I'm borderline offended. I'm working my way up to being curious to being offended now.
I've never seen you this upset before.
I don't know.
And you were my prof, and I was not a good student.
Well, if you had done a story about how Carlton the Bear came to be mascot, like, you would have gotten your master's. In an undergrad program, I would have lobbied to get you an MA out of that.
If I write the story, will I get a raise?
I think we need to do this now. We need to put down these microphones. We need to walk down to 40 Bay Street, and we need to knock on that window until we get an answer. Mr. Shanahan, Carlton, explain yourself. I'm sorry.
According to Google, it was 1995. Did they
Does it say why?
No.
I want to know why. You know, that's it. I'm going to make a call.
Do you need to leave?
Right now, yes.
Okay, I'm going to...
Raptors are playing that. Like, Larry Tannenbaum might be in his courtside seat right now. We could walk down and say, Larry, what's up? With Carlton
the Bear. Full, like, CP24 reporter chasing them down the hallway?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Full anchorman.
All right, let's...
How did we get here from
I'm changing the subject. I'm the host. I'm trying to rein it back in. Even though it's really hilarious. I'm so happy that now everyone, that's your more homework. Please find this out. Tweet us.
Semi-serious crowdsourcing. Who here would weird a story about how the Leafs got Carlton the Bear as a mascot? Okay. All right. I will aim to have that.
Scott, why didn't he raise your hand?
Wheels. I can see you, Wheels. You know what? I'm going to aim before the playoffs to find out how Carlton the Bear was a polar bear mascot for the Toronto Maple Leafs. If I get banned from Air Canada Center, then we never had this conversation.
I think I don't even know what I asked you.
It was about Gritty and
it's fine.
Like
I don't know if I care about it anymore. Yeah. Dan, Sean's done speaking. Dan, you spoke about your Ray Emery story. Yeah. You've also written, you know, a few books with some pretty big name people. Is there anything that you wanted to share about some of the novels that you've worked on and what that process is like?
Yeah, well, actually, Sean was talking about the research that he puts into his stories, and I imagine his Toronto Library search is going to have a lot of Carlton the Bear in it when he gets home tonight. But that's sort of central to everything I've done. So I wrote a book with Doug Gilmore and one with the great Buck Martinez and one with Clint Malarchuk, which is about a lot of kind of crazy stuff that he went through in his life. And then a couple of biographies of Pat Quinn and Johnny Bauer. But in all of those processes, it's been a lot of... Before diving into someone's life, I had to learn as much as I could about their life before... in Pat Quinn and Johnny's case, it was after they passed away. But in the case of where I was sitting down with, like, Doug, for example, to chat with him, I had to learn as much as possible about him and about a guy who's been written about a ton. And my whole goal when I go and write a book like that is to try and tell a story that people don't know about someone who's been well-covered throughout their life. So, for example, with Johnny Bauer, he passed away last... a year and a bit ago now. And right after that, HarperCollins asked me to write a book about him. The process was quite difficult because you're like, well, everyone's talked about Johnny Bauer and everyone's been writing about Johnny Bauer. But the great thing about Johnny Bauer is that he lied throughout his life about a ton of different things. And so the process of going back and untangling all of those sort of stories that he told and looking back at what his life was like in Prince Albert growing up during the Great Depression, then going off to war, and then coming back and changing his name. His estrangement with his brother that no one knew he had, all that kind of stuff was kind of a fascinating exploration for me to be able to dive into and sort of unravel sort of the mythology that Johnny created about himself, and which is an incredible mythology and one that obviously he earned in terms of his place with the Leafs and his continued presence there. But it was a real experience to try and go back and look at sort of what he had said and then try and figure out what was true.
And Sean had his, his great white whale of 20 questions. Is there someone that you really, really want to tell a story about, or, you know, either in an article or in a long form book format? Is there someone that, you know, you really want to profile?
That's a good question. I don't know right now. I'm kind of, one person would be Mario Lemieux, who's definitely not talking. I've tried to talk to Mario Lemieux to do a book, and he's not speaking, or Eric Lindros. There's kind of people that are like the big names, players that still haven't really done their experience of getting out there and talking about in depth about their life. And both of them have very interesting stories, I think, to tell that haven't been fully told yet. But they don't feel the need to sort of, you know, come out and share them. So that would be fantastic to get to be able to sit down one day and chat with them and be able to help them tell their stories. But I don't think they're doing it for a while still.
My dad was a golf pro, like not on the PGA Tour, but he had his pro card, and he worked at Lake Nona in Florida, and Mario Lemieux went there in the 1 year where he hurt his back and he missed like a playoff game, and my dad went up to him and he's like, how's your back doing? Like, why aren't you playing? Because my dad was a... he was a fan, and my dad was like berating Mario Lemieux on a golf course, and not well. Mario was just like, it's fine. He's like, how are you swinging golf club if your back's hurting? You can't play hockey, but you're playing golf, Mario? And I'm like, Dad, I wasn't alive, and I'm still like, Dad, what are you doing? Like,
my only interaction with Mario so far is I was at a Penguins game in Pittsburgh, and we got in the elevator together, him and his wife, and like they're both like 5 feet taller than me.
Was it really awkward?
It was. I didn't say a word. I just stood there, and they just stood there, and then he got out and said... he like nodded at me, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is crazy. And then he walked away, and I was like, that was not cool. I wasn't very cool. I didn't even say hi.
I had that experience with Brendan Shanahan last year in an elevator, because I did some of the, you know, game ops stuff with the Marlies, and we had a game at the Air Canada Center, and me and my friend were just like walking, and we hop in the elevator, and then Brendan Shanahan's standing right there just kind of staring at us, and we're like, do we have to get out? And we just kind of awkwardly stood there with Brendan Shanahan, and we just stopped speaking, and no one spoke, and no one looked at each other. I was just looking at the ground. I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, do you want me to leave? It was the most awkward elevator ride of my existence. And now here I am, you know, working, covering hockey, and I hope to God I never have to be in a press conference with Brendan Shanahan, because he's going to know. He's going to know I was that awkward elevator girl.
Wait, you're going to be the one who asked Brendan Shanahan about Carlton the Bear. Brandon, Carlton, WTF.
Why? I had a similar experience with Doug when I was writing Doug's book. When we talked on the phone the first time, I was really sweaty and nervous. I was like, okay, well, hope he likes me. And then we were going to meet at a bar. We did wrote the whole book at, what's it called? On Leaside. I can't think of the name right now. Originals. We were, we met there every... for lunch. He basically has a key. Like he and his previous wife lived around the corner from it, and all through the '90s he'd go there all the time. He knows the owners and everything. He knows the people, the custodial staff and everybody. So we'd go in there before it was open, and we'd just sit there for a couple of hours when I was supposed to be working at Sportsnet, and we'd just be he would just chat. But when I first met him, I was really nervous, and then he ended up just being the most incredible guy to sit and talk with, and the most sort of laid back, chill, kind of relaxed guy who, like I said, knew everybody's name and was sort of the most, you know, basically Doug from Kingston. So it was real, like, the initial sort of like awe goes away quickly when you actually sit down and chat with somebody and realize they're just regular people.
My cranky yelling at Mario Lemieux dad has a copy of that book, and I... We got it signed from Doug as a Christmas gift, and like he loved it. He does not cry. He doesn't hate you like he hates Mario Lemieux.
I'm glad to hear that.
Is there anything, you know, I'm sure there's been a lot of stuff that you gather and in the time that you spend with athletes that doesn't get into the stuff that you publish. Is there something that, you know, for the both of you that didn't make publication that is something really interesting that will always stand out to you that wasn't actually published for the masses?
I mean, just because Ray Emery is sort of top of mind. There was a lot of... the first draft of the story was like 12,000 words, and it was a total mess. And I think Ian and James for helping me with sorting it out and trying to get through the process of telling the story. But obviously, I think the last version is 7,000 words, so it's 5,000 words less. And I always knew it needed to be short, but that meant 5,000 words that I'd spent writing weren't going to be in it. And that's often the case with a long-form story. You need to... I always believe being as brief in a long-form story as possible is the best way to write a long-form story. You need to sort of think, okay, I have this space, but I have to keep people with me the whole time. But there were some facts that I felt, like scenes that just didn't fit or that I thought were a bit difficult. So one example, Keisha Shante, who's a pop singer and does ET in the U.S. now, she was Ray's partner for 7 years. And there was, a long relationship, and they broke up in difficult fashion, and there was a domestic abuse allegation and charge against him, so I had to speak with him about that. So it was really difficult. We had a long conversation, but she talked a lot about Ray's struggle with identity, and the one thing that she brought up was this concept of his biological father. So one of the big mysteries was sort of who Ray's biological father was, and that story he had throughout his like life, the people he was close with, he'd maybe bring it up a little bit, but he always said, I don't want to find my biological father because my adopted father is my dad. He's the only dad I need. And he would go on like about that. And he had a lot of anger issues though, and a lot of things he didn't understand. So he thought about trying to find him. And one day, Keisha was telling me she actually found him on Facebook. And Ray came in the room, and he was upset and got really sort of like angry, went away and said, I don't want to find him. I don't want to see him again. I didn't put that in the story this time because I felt it was very powerful, but at the same time, there's a challenge with writing about Ray because Ray isn't here to talk about his feelings. And then, so I had to try and be sensitive to, I couldn't understand sort of the why in that question. So I tried to, in the story, only write what I could know, based on what people would say that he told them or about that. But the sort of mystery about him and those sort of moments that were really difficult, I didn't feel I had the right to put into the story. I probably shouldn't talk about it, but I mean, it's just sort of the, I think it was revealing about Ray and this sort of constant struggle he had later on, and part of me wanted to put it in, but I decided that it was something that I just will leave out. So that's one of the things, yeah.
Sean? No mascots allowed, please.
I was going to say,
we don't need a tangent. Another one.
When Ralph the Hound has to say about Carlton the Bear. What would he say about Carlton the Bear? No, I mean, I don't dabble in long form quite that often, so I honestly can't. I mean, I've come away really impressed with the people that I've interviewed before. I've come away after very long conversations. I've come away from stories where, and I mean, Ray Emery's story would be one for you, but where something just sticks with you, something lingers. There was a story I did about a former hockey player named Craig Fisher, who lives in Whitby, Ontario, and he was the coach of UOIT, University of Ontario Institute of Technology. And he suddenly sort of just had to retire. He was a coach of the varsity men's hockey team, and he retired. And sort of it was a press release, and then the local paper in Durham did a really nice job sort of explaining that, you know, he had a history of concussion, and, you know, he just felt it was time to step away. And I was curious about it, so I took a look, and, you know, he was one of those guys who had a couple of seasons that looked like they were fueled by lightning strikes. Like really lightning strikes, like Teemu Selanne in a level below the NHL lightning strikes, like 63 goals, 72 goals in the IHL, like a guy who could really play and who really might have made a name for himself in the big league, except there was one game he was in Rochester playing for the Amerks, and he was going up the ice. And I didn't ask him about this because he has no memory of it, so I called his teammates who haven't thought about him in 15 years. One of them, when I called them, a real estate agent in Edmonton, said, you know, he was really sad when he picked up the phone. And I'm calling just to talk about the guy. And he's like, well, I thought you were calling to tell me he was dead, because I thought that the next call I would have got about Craig Fisher would that he'd been passed away, because he was in such bad shape that this goal scorer, this dynamic forward, was going up the ice just on a regular play. Completely random, like you do it in beer league, you do it in, you know, intramurals, you do it anytime you step on the ice, just up the ice, and a guy clipped him. So clipped him in the head, sort of jolted him back. So they figured that's about the first time he got a concussion. Like that motion was violent enough that he probably got a concussion there. Well, when he jerked back, a teammate was coming up, and he fell back in his knee. The teammate's knee hit him in the face while he was on the way down. So he got jerked, then down, then hit in the face with the knee. So maybe that was the second one, another violent concussion. And so when he went down on the ice, he landed face first on the ice. So that could be three traumatic brain injuries or three traumatic brain events in one play. So went to the hospital. They discharged him that night. His wife had just given birth. They had a 2-year-old daughter, I believe, at that point. And like the story was that, you know, they're in this hospital in Rochester, and she's trying to wheel out her husband in a wheelchair while the husband, who doesn't really know where he is pushing the stroller in front of the wheelchair while he's seated. So what happened was is his career ended. Like, ended that instant. They brought him in. He spent months. I mean, it's kind of the old story of what we're... I mean, now it's an old story of what we learn about concussion, that he couldn't listen to any sound. Like, even his daughter. Like, I don't know if anybody has any kids. I know Cloak's still around. He knows kids don't tend to be quiet. but his daughter was, because he couldn't stand any noise, because anything was just like anvils falling on plates of glass for him. He had to stay in a room really darkly lit for months, like not just a couple weeks, months. Couldn't do a thing. By the end of that season, and the Emmerichs were pretty good back then, by the end of that season, the teammates that I was talking to said they brought him in, and it looked like he was a 90-year-old man. That this, you know, really dynamic forward was coming in, and he had sunglasses, his hat was low, and he was shuffling. And he was just kind of going up and shaking hands and saying good luck in the playoffs. It seemed like a completely different guy. So I did all of these interviews before I went and sat down with Craig Fisher and his wife, who's a lovely lady with a handshake like a vice grip, because she's had to carry the burden of this family for years. Like he can't put his car keys in a different spot when he gets home, because if they're not in that one basket, he'll never find them. Like, you know, when you park your car, he described this, when you park your car and you're going to IKEA on a Saturday, if you're damn foolhardy enough to do that, and you forget where you park your car. Eventually, like, oh yeah, it was over by the sign closest to the highway. He never has those moments, because the circuitry in his brain has been rewired so viciously from those hits and still hasn't healed decades later that he will never have that aha moment. So it's really challenging. And when I sat down with him, he said that, you know, after playing, coaching was his dream job, that when he got that job at UOIT, it was his dream job. But he found himself that he was a little bit trailing the play, that the puck might come zipping into the bench and he might be sort of, he called it his happy zone, sort of staring off into space, that, you know, line combinations, he couldn't remember them as quickly as he needed to. So stepping down, and UOIT was great. They gave him a job in the front office at the athletic department to sort of coordinate travel and do really important stuff, but not be doing what he loves. But, you know, he's still young. He's still fit. But he doesn't know what's coming up next. And I remember sitting down with them in this beautiful dining room in sort of the old corner of Whitby, in a beautiful, warm house. There might have actually been a real fire going, but it could have been a TV. My memory sort of foggy on that. But this wonderful wood table, and his wife was there, and he was there, and he was talking about losing his dream twice, losing his dream as a player, losing his dream as a coach. And now what he's left with is he's got a teenage daughter, and she's great, and she's going to university, but he doesn't know what's next. Like, he said that, you know, with all that we're learning about chronic traumatic encephalopathy and the dangers of repeated head trauma, that he doesn't know at this age what he might look like in 5 years or in 10 years, and that's really frightening. And the thing, so we're talking about what sticks with you, is the thing that stuck with me is that after a couple of hours we were sitting there, the exertion of just sitting there and talking had exhausted him. Like, he was losing focus. He just physically exhausted. And one of the last things he said before I finally sort of got up and left the table was, you know, I only hope that whatever happens, that I end up in my happy place. That if I drift off and I'm not tethered to this reality anymore, that I go to the happy place where I sometimes go, and that's where it ends for me. And I got up. I shook hands again, said thank you so much, and I went out to my car on the street and looked in, and their window shades were sort of drawn open, and his wife leaned over and gave him a hug, and he was sort of sobbing and patted her on the arm, and she helped him up the stairs. And it was just such a moment of humanity, of fear, of bravery, of telling a stranger a story that intimate that sticks with me still. And it's still one of those experiences that, I mean, you've had that I'll just never forget. And, I mean, when somebody tells you that, it's a huge responsibility to make sure you get that story right. And it's just something that, like, I'll never forget.
I have nothing to follow with that. I mean, does anyone have any questions in the audience? Anyone have questions for Dan or Sean? No? Nothing?
We're willing to field Carlton the Bear questions.
Yeah. I think we were supposed to wrap at 9:30, so we have about 5 more minutes, it looks like. If there's no other questions, I mean, is there any other stories that really stick with you? Or, I mean, any tips that you have? I mean, is there a story that you wanted to tell that you came in here and really wanting to share today?
I mean, I always just live in the stories that I'm working on right now. So I know this one that I'm writing, I'm really excited to do because it was, I think, a really unique experience in terms of seeing what hockey can mean to a group of people in Canada that are very much underrepresented. So getting to go to Rankin Inlet and hang out with these Inuit communities that are remote, that basically travel 200 kilometers or more by snowmobile to get to this tournament and play. And when they're not playing, when they're not in the tournaments, they just play against each other in their communities because there's no other place to actually go. That was just a really interesting experience for me because I got to go and sit in this old arena that was dripping from the ceiling and people were hanging over the boards and they're all there to see Jordan, but they're also there to compete for their communities. So it was a really eye-opening experience. I think we all think that hockey's tied into the fabric of being Canadian and all this kind of stuff, but in that place, in those communities, it is a part of it's a part of life in a way that isn't a part of life anywhere else. They play 2 hours a night every single night, and in many cases, it's what keeps people from being involved in other things that are more destructive. And so it was a real eye-opening experience seeing that with Jordan Tutu and talking to him about that and the legacy of his brother who committed suicide. It was a really moving sort of time for me. We visited a local healing center or prison, and I remember we walked into one of the inmates was in the guest was in solitary confinement, and he'd been in a fight earlier that week. And he's a guy who'd just been in for 2 years, got out for 2 days, and then got sent back, probably intentionally, because of the care that he gets there that he doesn't get elsewhere. I mean, there's horrible situations with boil water advisories and overcrowding in homes and poverty in these communities. So he got back in, got in a fight. He's in this in solitary because of that. And we went in and visited him, and he had Jordan Tutu's book on his bed that he had that they'd lent him, and he was reading it. And his reaction was just incredible when he saw Jordan walk in the room. And then when he said, you know, I didn't know your life was like that, because Jordan has a great book with Stephen Brunt that outlines a lot of the difficulties that he faced growing up. It was just a really moving experience to see what someone like Jordan can mean to the people that are from his community and the people that he grew up with and he knew, and then also what hockey can mean to a group of people that I really do think, like, anywhere else in Canada has nothing on what hockey in the North means to a community.
Sean, any final words or final stories you wanted to share?
I think we all know the one that's on my mind now, so I don't think we need to really, I don't think we need to explore that anymore. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to blow this story up here, and it started here tonight. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
We started something at Puck Talks this evening, so I guess on that note, we will wrap it up here. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. This was a different format that we did today, you know, talking about storytelling instead of digging into trades and contracts and that kind of stuff in hockey. So I hope you all enjoyed that format. I hope you all enjoyed listening to some of these fabulous storytellers that we had today. So a final round of applause for Sean and Dan and the other two, Josh and the other two, no, Joshua Cloak and Scott Wheeler for joining us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.